Imagine for a second that you are exactly two votes away from the presidency of the United States. Just, you know, two electoral votes.
Right, literally on the edge.
Yeah, you have completely swept the Sun Belt. You've secured Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, and North Carolina.
Huge wins.
Massive. And you've held on to every single state in the traditional conservative base. The balloons are netted in the ceiling. The champagne is, like, practically uncorked in the war room.
Uh-huh.
But the math says you lose.
Yeah, it is the ultimate political nightmare scenario.
It really is.
And avoiding that specific, agonizing mathematical dead end requires, well, years of invisible, ruthless calculus.
And today we are looking at those exact invisible blueprints. It is August 18th, 2026, and we are unpacking a really fascinating, highly detailed strategic analysis document. It was published by the American newspaper and American TV.
A really comprehensive piece of work.
Oh, absolutely. The mission of this deep dive today is to explore the hypothetical 2028 presidential campaign strategy of Marco Rubio. And for you listening, whether you are a total political junkie or, you know, you're just intensely curious about how these high-level campaigns are actually engineered behind closed doors, this deep dive is going to reveal how political narratives are constructed, like long before a candidate ever announces they are actually running.
Years before, usually.
Exactly. We are getting into primary coalitions, economic nationalism, electoral college math, and foreign policy.
But before we go any further into those blueprints, I do need to make a very clear disclaimer for you listening.
Yes, very important.
This source document contains highly politically charged content. I mean, it touches heavily on both left-wing and right-wing viewpoints, policies, and, you know, partisan strategies.
Right.
So I want to make it abundantly clear that neither of us here is taking a side. We are not endorsing Marco Rubio, J.D. Vance, or any other candidate.
Definitely not.
Nor are we validating the political viewpoints of the original authors of this text. Our job today is strictly and impartially to analyze the strategic scenarios, the data, and the campaign architecture presented in this specific document.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand the 2028 strategy, we have to start with the incredibly bizarre reality of where Marco Rubio is right now.
Bizarre is definitely the word for it.
Right. We are beginning with what the document calls the incumbency paradox. His current position in the executive branch is historically unprecedented.
Yeah.
It is simultaneously like the greatest asset he could possibly ask for and the biggest structural hurdle to actually running a campaign.
The term paradox is almost an understatement here, to be honest. Let's look at his day-to-day reality. Right now, Rubio is serving as the 72nd U.S. Secretary of State.
Which is huge on its own.
That alone makes him the chief diplomat of the country. But he's also dual-hatted. White House records officially identify him as the assistant to the president and acting national security advisor.
Wait, both? So he isn't just executing foreign policy, he is literally in the room designing it.
Exactly.
He is at the absolute dead center of diplomacy, military policy, intelligence briefings, daily presidential decision-making. I mean, if there is a global crisis, he is the one waking up at 3 a.m. to brief the Oval Office.
What's fascinating here is how that exact governmental strength completely paralyzes his campaign freedom.
Oh, interesting. How so?
Well, because of these dual roles, he has built this unparalleled serious governing brand. But that also binds his political fate to every single success, every hidden cost, and every public controversy of the Trump administration's foreign policy.
So he basically owns it all, good or bad?
Completely. He can't distance himself from it.
Yeah.
Furthermore, there is no formal campaign apparatus, like, at all.
Really? Nothing?
As of mid-August 2026, he has publicly stated he has no plans to run. He even said he would actually back Vice President J.D. Vance if Vance enters the race. And if you pull the Federal Election Commission filings, Rubio's legacy presidential passy, which is essentially the leftover political bank account from his previous electoral runs,
right.
It reported exactly $0 in receipts and $0 in disbursements between January 2025 and June 2026.
$0. I mean, you cannot build a 50-state political machine with $0.
You really can't.
And yet, the public demand is sitting right there in the data. The sources point to a July 2026 Emerson poll that showed a statistical dead heat for a hypothetical primary. It had J.D. Vance at 39%, Marco Rubio at 38%.
A one-point difference.
Yeah. So the voters are highly interested, but the infrastructure is non-existent. It's like trying to build a brand new airplane in the aisle while you are currently the co-pilot of a 747 in mid-flight.
That is a great way to put it.
Right, because if you reach for a wrench to start building your own plane, the passengers and the pilot are going to panic that you aren't flying this plane. So how does he prepare a campaign without looking like he's actively plotting a mutiny against his boss?
Well, the short answer is that he can't openly organize.
Just flat out can't do it.
Right. Any leaked memo about a primary run in Iowa, for instance, would instantly be framed as a distraction from his national security duties.
Oh, the media would have a field day.
Exactly. His strategy relies on perfect timing. He has to wait for an opening and execute a flawless overnight rollout.
But because he can't openly test the waters or slowly build momentum, a sudden launch leaves zero room for error.
None.
And that forces us to look at the historical baggage he carries. If the launch has to be completely flawless, he has to prove he has exorcised the ghosts of his past.
So let's talk about the shadow of 2016.
Yeah, we have to talk about 2016. The 2016 Republican primary is the defining cautionary tale of this entire strategic architecture.
It really is.
The report notes the bitter rivalry with Donald Trump, who, you know, famously branded him with the little Marco moniker.
Right. That stuck for a long time.
It did. But the deep structural damage, the kind that alters a politician's trajectory for a decade, that came during a February 2016 New Hampshire debate. The Chris Christie debate? Oh, man.
Yeah.
For anyone who watched that live, it was an exercise in pure, visceral, secondhand embarrassment.
It was painful.
It felt like watching a computer glitch in real time.
And the mechanics of that glitch are exactly what matter for 2028. Christie brutally attacked Rubio for relying on a memorized 25-second script.
Right.
Now, all politicians use what are called memorized bridges. It's a tactic where you acknowledge a difficult question for maybe 3 seconds.
Mm.
And then immediately pivot to a pre-written, highly polished talking point.
Sure, debate prep 101.
Exactly. And Rubio was famous for being incredibly disciplined at this. But under the high pressure of that specific debate moment, his discipline backfired.
Big time.
He repeated the exact same prepackaged lines, criticizing Barack Obama multiple times in a row, word for word.
And Christie caught him.
Christie pointed it out as it was happening, on stage, cementing this robotic or Marcobat image that derailed his momentum entirely.
The document also highlights his involvement in the 2013 Gang of Eight immigration bill. Just to remind you listening, that was a major bipartisan legislative push that paired heavy border security measures with a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants.
Right, back in 2013.
Yeah, and in the political climate of 2013, it was seen as a necessary compromise. But in the context of a modern Magie primary, that bill is viewed as a massive amnesty attack liability.
The lesson from 2016 isn't just that he lost his home state of Florida. It's about the underlying psychology of the electorate.
How do you mean?
Well, Rubio's former greatest strength, his flawless message delivery, was weaponized against him as proof of inauthenticity. Like, he wasn't a real person.
Right.
So the strategic takeaway for a 2028 debate prep team is that he can never, ever rely on those memorized bridges again. He has to master an answer-first, evidence-specific response style.
Wait, what does that actually look like on a debate stage? Give me the mechanics of an answer-first response versus his old 2016 playbook.
Sure. So instead of dodging a question about inflation to pivot to a canned speech about the American dream, an answer-first approach means starting with a direct yes or no.
Okay.
Then he has to build the argument in real time, using raw data and localized examples. Something like, yes, inflation is hurting families, and here is the specific tariff policy I drafted last Tuesday to address it.
Ah.
It shows the gears turning in his head, which proves he isn't just playing a tape recorder.
Let me challenge the premise of this entire vulnerability, though.
Go ahead.
That debate was well over a decade ago. He is literally managing global crises today.
True.
In the era of TikTok and algorithmic feeds, where political memories seem to last about 3 seconds, does one awkward debate clip from 2016 really still define his authenticity today?
Well, the strategic document argues that it absolutely does, because opposition research teams never forget.
Fair point.
In our current digital ecosystem, that 2016 clip can be clipped, remixed, and reactivated instantly to frame any slight hesitation today as him reverting to his robot programming.
Wow, so the past really is prologue here.
It is. That's why the document stresses that his current policy platform must feel deeply authentic and rooted in a long legislative record, not just some new script he memorized to sound populist for 2028.
So, to shed that 2016 skin, He couldn't just change his debate style. He had to rebuild his political DNA.
Exactly.
The document details a massive ideological shift over the last decade, specifically a profound move toward economic nationalism.
Yeah, this is a huge pivot. Yeah. If you examine his brand from 2010 to 2016, it was deeply rooted in the Tea Party movement.
Right.
He championed supply-side economics, the classic belief that cutting taxes and regulations for businesses will spur growth that eventually trickles down to workers.
Reaganomics, basically.
Precisely. He favored free enterprise and a very traditional free trade internationalist foreign policy. But the sources document a deliberate philosophical shift starting around 2019 and 2020.
Okay.
He began actively advocating for what he calls common good capitalism,
which is a fundamental departure from the Reagan-era orthodoxy the Republican Party ran on for 40 years.
Oh, it completely flips the traditional conservative economic model.
Wow.
Common good capitalism argues that while free markets are important, the market shouldn't be the ultimate master. Economic policy should actively be manipulated by the government to serve domestic productive capacity, dignified working class jobs, and family stability.
Okay, that is a huge shift.
And the timeline is the critical mechanism here. This isn't a sudden 2028 pivot just to mirror Donald Trump's rhetoric. By 2024, Rubio was actively proposing a heavy pro-American industrial policy.
He started pushing for aggressive China-focused economic security. We are talking about highly specific mechanisms, like barring Chinese firms from evading U.S. tariffs by manufacturing their goods in third-party countries like Mexico and then shipping them across the border.
Right.
He actually wants the government to intervene to protect American manufacturing.
And here's the friction that creates. He is actively bridging two completely different political universes. Well, on one side, he has deep historical ties to traditional GOP business elites. The report specifically notes that Wall Street megadonor Ken Griffin signaled serious interest in backing Rubio over J.D. Vance.
Okay.
But on the other side, Rubio desperately needs the working class MAGA base to actually win the primary votes.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because those two groups want wildly opposite things.
They really do.
We've seen politicians try to please Wall Street and Main Street simultaneously before. Look at Mitt Romney trying to shake the vulture capitalist label in 2012 while appealing to blue-collar workers. It usually ends in alienating everybody.
Yeah.
It's like trying to be the loud champion for the local mom-and-pop hardware store while your campaign is quietly being funded by the massive big-box corporate executives. Can you actually hold both of those alliances together without one turning on you? How does Rubio survive that squeeze?
It is an incredibly volatile tightrope. I mean, the Wall Street donor class wants free markets, due regulation, predictable corporate tax rates, and free trade. But the MAGA base wants protective tariffs, restrictions on foreign capital, and aggressive worker-first interventions.
Total opposites.
If Rubio leans too hard into common good capitalism, the donors pull their funding, labeling him a protectionist. If he caters to the donors, the populist base brands him a corporate sellout.
So what's his defense?
The document argues his only defense is his actual legislative paper trail. He has to point to the bills he authored in 2020 to prove his industrial policy is a genuine governing philosophy, not just campaign season pandering.
But, you know, having a philosophy of economic nationalism only matters if there are actual voters buying what you are selling.
Mm-hmm.
And that forces us to look at the demographics and specifically the deeply misunderstood myth of the Latino vote.
Oh, this part of the analysis is fascinating. The analytical report is incredibly blunt about this. Treating Hispanic voters as a single monolithic Latino vote is a massive analytical shortcut that campaigns use at their own peril.
It's just not accurate.
Not at all.
The sources cite validated voter data from Pew showing that Donald Trump won roughly 48% of the Hispanic vote in 2024.
Which is a staggering realignment from just 4 years prior.
Truly staggering. But the document issues a severe warning. This shift is highly elastic. It is a temporary lease, not a permanent partisan capture.
And the mechanics of candidate identity get highly complicated here. Rubio's Cuban-American heritage and his family's anti-communist narrative resonate deeply in South Florida.
Right.
It is a perfect cultural match for that specific region. But the data proves that his South Florida identity does not automatically transfer to Mexican-American voters in Arizona or Nevada.
Because their primary concerns aren't rooted in anti-communist foreign policy.
Precisely. Working-class Hispanic voters in the Southwest are prioritizing the severe cost of living, service sector wage stagnation, and chaotic border management.
Totally different issues.
Furthermore, his Cuban heritage doesn't automatically translate to Puerto Rican voters in Pennsylvania, who are heavily focused on mainland economic integration and public services.
You cannot just speak Spanish in a campaign ad and expect to sweep Nevada and Pennsylvania.
You really can't.
And this brings us to the most ruthless part of the document, the Electoral College math. Because Florida, where Rubio's identity plays best, is no longer a swing state. The document treats Florida as a structurally locked base defense state for Republicans.
Yeah, to understand the 2028 strategy, you have to look at the rigid arithmetic of the 2024 baseline map.
Okay, walk me through it.
If you exclude the seven main battleground states, the guaranteed Republican base sits at 219 electoral votes.
Okay, 219. And we know you need 270 to win the presidency. So you need to find 51 electoral votes.
Right.
Let's say Rubio leans heavily into his Hispanic heritage and completely sweeps the diverse Sunbelt battlegrounds. He wins Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, and North Carolina.
Okay, if you add up those four Sunbelt states, they give you exactly 49 electoral votes. You add that to the 219 base, and you arrive at 268 electoral votes.
268. You fall two votes short. That is the nightmare scenario we opened with. You run a flawless Sunbelt campaign, and you still lose the presidency.
Because the math dictates the message. A Sunbelt strategy alone is a losing strategy.
Wow.
You must pair the Sunbelt with the Rust Belt. The minimum winning path the document outlines is holding the 219 base, holding North Carolina and Georgia, and then capturing Pennsylvania's 19 electoral votes. That gets you to exactly 270.
So what does this all mean for his core messaging? Is the document arguing that leaning too heavily on his historic potential to be the first Hispanic president might actually backfire if he doesn't deliver the exact economic goods those specific localized communities want, like blue-collar workers in Erie, Pennsylvania, for instance?
That is the exact strategic warning. His heritage is an incredible entry point, but it is not a substitute for localized economic policy.
Right.
If he wants to win Wisconsin, Michigan, or Pennsylvania, his campaign cannot rely on biographical identity. It must ruthlessly hammer home that Made in America industrial messaging, proving he will protect their specific manufacturing jobs from foreign undercutting.
Because if he loses the Rust Belt...
If he loses the Rust Belt, he loses the map.
Okay, so he has evolved his messaging. He understands the perilous math of the map. But standing squarely between Marco Rubio and that 270 electoral vote threshold is the most formidable obstacle possible. Vice President J.D. Vance.
Yeah, Vance holds the ultimate structural advantage here.
He really does.
He has the immense platform of the vice presidency. He holds the mantle of the younger populist movement identity. And he has a massive head start in sheer political logistics.
Right. The report notes Vance is already building infrastructure, traveling to early primary states like Iowa and cultivating donors.
And beyond the logistics of ground games and donor lists, the document outlines a very sharp, irreconcilable foreign policy cleavage between the two men.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this contrast between Rubio and Vance isn't just a clash of two ambitious politicians.
Whoa.
No, it is a fundamental battle for the soul and the future direction of the Republican Party.
Wow.
Vance represents a posture of deep restraint. He is explicitly skeptical of prolonged U.S. military involvement abroad, highly critical of continued funding for foreign conflicts, and openly hostile to the traditional elite foreign policy consensus.
Whereas Rubio represents what the strategic analysis calls alliance using America First.
Which is a very distinct philosophy.
Right.
Rubio is far more comfortable projecting coercive military power and relying on forward deterrence. He actively wants to leverage NATO and Indo-Pacific partnerships to contain adversaries like China.
So not exactly isolationist.
Not at all. It is not the blank check liberal internationalism of the 1990s. He demands heavy financial burden sharing from those allies.
Yeah.
But it is a significantly more interventionist, globally engaged posture than Vance's camp.
The report details five distinct scenarios for how this 2028 primary plays out, and essentially all of them hinge on the sitting president.
Right. Trump is the wild card.
If Donald Trump explicitly endorses Rubio, his mathematical probability of securing the nomination jumps to between 55 and 75%.
Huge bump.
But if Trump remains neutral and lets them fight it out, and Vance decides to run, it becomes a fierce, incredibly volatile competition for control of the Maginet coalition.
It would be a brutal primary.
But let me push back on Rubio's foreign policy readiness being treated as a pure asset.
Sure.
If a major global crisis breaks out, say a blockade in Taiwan or an escalation with Iran, the report suggests Rubio's daily experience managing those exact crises gives him a massive advantage.
Yes, the serious governing brand.
Right, but couldn't an opponent easily weaponize that? Couldn't Vance's camp paint him as a classic neocon? Like a neoconservative relic who is eager to drag the U.S. into another 20-year endless war?
That's a very real threat.
Doesn't his greatest resume builder, being Secretary of State, potentially become his fatal flaw with a base that desperately wants out of foreign entanglements?
Well, the strategic document actually features a detailed risk matrix that highlights exactly that vulnerability.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The political outcome depends entirely on the nature of the crisis. If a foreign conflict is perceived by the public as swift, successful, and limited in scope, Rubio looks like a highly competent, battle-tested commander.
Okay, that makes sense.
But if the situation devolves into a prolonged, costly quagmire, he becomes the immediate, most visible target for the anti-war, populist wing of his own party.
He'd be the face of the war.
Exactly. To survive, he has to prove that his version of peace through strength actually includes rigid limits on the use of force.
So bringing all these complex threads together, the puzzle of a Rubio 2028 run is almost unimaginably intricate.
Intricate is putting it mildly.
He has to balance his unprecedented high-stakes national security duties with somehow building an undercover campaign organization without angering the White House. He has to shake off the robotic debate ghost of 2016 by mastering an entirely new way of speaking.
The answer first method.
Right. He has to sell a unified message of economic nationalism that keeps both Wall Street billionaires and working class populists happy, which requires defying political gravity.
Basically impossible.
And he has to navigate an electoral map that demands he win over blue-collar voters in the Rust Belt, all while somehow overcoming the massive structural and organizational advantage held by the sitting vice president.
It is an incredibly narrow needle to thread, requiring almost flawless execution over the span of 2 years.
And for you listening, I think what makes this analysis so fascinating isn't just the inside baseball gossip of who is up and who is down.
Right.
It's seeing how this elite, high-level strategy takes the utter chaos of human behavior, unpredictable global crises, and massive mountains of demographic data, and attempts to engineer a rigid mathematical path to victory.
It really pulls back the curtain on the blueprints of power.
It really does.
And, you know, this raises an important question, and it leaves us with a final, slightly provocative thought to mull over.
Oh.
We talked at the beginning about the incumbency paradox.
Right.
Based on the strategic architecture we've just analyzed, we may have entered a bizarre new era of politics. An era where having actual high-level governing experience managing the State Department, directing national security, might actually make you less viable as a presidential candidate than a complete outsider who can promise the world without being tied to a voting record.
Wow, that is dark.
If a seasoned leader's entire strategic path requires quietly waiting for their boss's blessing or waiting for the vice president to stumble, are we witnessing the end of the traditional ideas-based primary campaign?
That's a good question.
Have we replaced the democratic insurgency of a primary entirely with a system of royal succession?
It really makes you wonder who is actually drawing the blueprints for our future. The voters at the ballot box or the architects in the back room?
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.